Simon Sharma is a professor of history and art history at Columbia University. He's written many books on history and art, including Landscape and Memory, Dead Certainties, and Rembrandt's Eyes. He wrote and hosted a 15-part BB series on the history of Britain. Welcome to KABU.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You know, your latest book, Rough Crossings, is about the role of slaves in the American Revolution, and specifically their relationship with Great Britain.
Right.
And nothing is simple in your portrait of this time or the people in it.
Right.
Which is one of the things that makes it interesting. Now, at the time of the American Revolution, the British allowed slavery in their colonies,
yeah.
but not at home. Why
right.
was that?
It's called hypocrisy. but actually, it is a very interesting story, not to be facetious. There were about 15,000 blacks, many of them slaves, inside metropolitan Britain, overwhelmingly in London. And really, through a series of genuinely idealistic law campaigns, particularly fought by this man called Granville Sharp, who I talk about in the book, some of those idealists thought that slavery in Britain itself was incompatible with the English common law. It comes about through a series of cases involving escaped slaves. In other words, all these slaves who come back from the West Indies, where, as you rightly say, there's almost 250,000, you know, being worked to death on the sugar plantations. Rich masters come back to London, take a holiday, bring their body servants with them. Then their body servants think, life could be a lot better if I ran away. They run away. And then they're kidnapped back again. And sometimes resold again. And one day, this man called Granville Sharp finds a black called Jonathan Strong, who's been kind of beaten half to death by his hideously sadistic master. And they put him back together again and take care of him and get him a job. And then 3 years later, this man, Jonathan Strong, the black man, has the incredibly bad luck to run into his old hideous master, David Lyle, who kidnaps him. But something's happened to Jonathan Strong. He actually has learned to read and write. So he sends a letter to Granville Sharp, and Granville Sharp comes to the court, to the prison, gets the writ of habeas corpus, and actually he gets released. And he, Sharp, becomes a kind of legal eagle involving the blacks in Britain, and fights for the Lord Chief Justice, eventually wins the case. Now, big digression. What digress? Well, heaven. is that the law, what the law actually said was that in order for men to be treated like property, there had to be laws of particular countries. That was the legal ruling. In other words, local law had to establish a positive law, like a legal code, saying that slavery was legal. The default position under the English common law, it is argued by the abolitionists, is that you cannot be a thing. You, as long as you are in England itself, you are subject to the legal protection offered by the king.
Which didn't go to the colonies.
It didn't go to the colonies. Colonies were allowed to have their own particular law. So when I said hypocrisy facetiously, in a way it's a matter of expediency, economic expediency. What's truly interesting and remarkable about the British story is that from these little kind of ad hominem cases, a mass movement, a middle class mass movement, starts in Britain, which is genuinely aghast at the slave trade. And the slave trade is abolished in 200 years next February in 1807. But it doesn't rest there. Once the movement's kick-started, slavery itself, even though the sugar trade is going very strong, as we now know, slavery itself was abolished in 1833. And that's, you know, as Frederick Douglass said, that's if, you know, two generations before it was abolished in the United States.
What do you think laid the groundwork for this kind of sea change of worldview? I mean,
Religion. Yeah, I actually think that it's the Quakers who are the first heroes, actually, unsurprisingly, which is why Franklin is one of them, even though he wants America to win the war, who wouldn't? And therefore he's prepared to let his conscience ferment a little bit. But there's a genuine attempt at the end of the 18th century to have inclusive churches. The Baptist and the Methodist churches basically establish their appeal as a church of all men and all colours. And Wesley, for example, is a strong abolitionist. And my feeling is it comes... I'm not particularly starry-eyed, least of all about religion, actually. But I do think the impulse is essentially that. Added to that, there is a kind of secular enlightenment ideal which bubbles up both in Britain and America and France, some of which is embodied in the Declaration of Independence, that we are all born free and equal, and we are brothers and sisters under the skin. So that matters too. But if you say what actually creates a mass movement of people who are willing to work their rear ends off, it's a kind of faith.
So the churches were where this idea that had kind of bubbled up kind of spread from.
I think it's natural when you're actually in the kind of evangelical churches at that point. You have a network of similarly inclined pious people who you can go to. This terrific figure called Thomas Clarkson, who was going to be a clergyman, and is actually in the Church of England, the sort of Episcopalian church. But he's someone who is like a kind of old Christian apostle. He rides a horse, or he travels by a very simple coach or cart. But he goes from kind of rectory to rectory. They become the kind of cells of recruitment, for example, for the anti-sugar, the sugar boycott campaign that he organizes. And that's really along the lines. It's a bit like, you know, how involved people like Coffin were in the Vietnam peace movement. There was a very strong element of sort of pacifist evangelical church presence in that. And of course, from my point of view, what's unbelievably moving and inspiring is because we have two memoirs from black preachers themselves, one a Methodist and one a Baptist, you can actually see how the black churches, these are the first free black churches, how utterly committed to their fate as self-determining free Christians they all are.
Right, and one of them is the one who starts like going off in field and preaching, and eventually they have to build a platform because it's in Nova Scotia in the winter, and people are going there barefoot.
That's right.
That was just amazing.
Well, even I think more, he's called David George, and his memoir is very beautiful, dictated when he's at a Baptist seminary in England, but very close to the time he describes. It's a very rich, sort of inspirationally exalted kind of language he used, which is utterly like what we remember from Martin Luther King and people like that. But he baptizes whites for the first time. That's an amazing first, actually.
It doesn't make him real popular with his neighbors.
No, it doesn't. No, he's physically attacked. They want to kind of just burn down the chapels and drive him out of town.
He was part of this mass exodus that you describe of blacks during the American Revolution.
Right.
Now, can you tell us a little bit about what caused this exodus?
Right. It begins with an act of completely brutal military expediency. When we're talking about all our kind of wonderfully starry-eyed Christian evangelists, the last governor of Virginia, Lord Dunmore, is not one of them. He's your basic imperial nitwit, not a very good soldier, but he's down to his last 300 redcoats. We're in November 1775. Things are looking very grim. He's facing this huge rebellion. All the British troops are bottled up in Boston after Lexington and Concord with General Gage. That's where they thought the theater of the major war was going to be. So he desperately needs an army. It's been in the air because the British were cynically, had often armed Native Americans. Think, well, you know, maybe we'll give Jefferson and Washington and co. a real shock and arm free blacks. And the threat of doing it, they thought, would intimidate small farmers into forgetting about rebellion. Has the opposite effect, of course.
But only free blacks?
No. The aim is actually to emancipate escaped slaves. Excuse me, sorry, I didn't mean to give that impression. No, the proclamation in November says, it uses the word freedom for the first time, that any slaves escaping from rebel plantations, the deal was not on if you happen to have the misfortune of being a slave to a loyalist. But if you were on a rebel plantation and you got the hell out of it and made it to British lines, you were going to get your freedom. And that was a proclamation published and then repeated by Generals Howe and Clinton and Carleton, and that part of the bargain was pretty much lived up to. But it's one of these classic stories, exactly as you say, it's not very simple, but even out of a kind of cynical strategy move, inadvertent, extraordinarily powerful events may happen. The conservative figure is between 80 and 100,000 slaves. In other words, 20% of the entire slave population of America take the British up on the offer by voting with their feet, again, including Washington's slave. Half the signers of the Declaration of Independence in the South have slaves who go to the British. Arthur Middleton in South Carolina has 30 30 slaves who go as fast as they can to the British. So it is the first great epic odyssey of African-American history at this moment. So it should be in every damn social studies textbook in the country.
Well, the problem is it really doesn't paint a good picture.
It's inconvenient.
It's like very inconvenient.
It's a bit of a party poop. Like Frederick Douglass said, what is your 4th of July to me? But look, you know, I tell you, you can think about history two ways, you know. It can be kind of thumb-sucking, feel-good. I mean, because whatever out there, wherever your position on the political spectrum is, and why do I have the feeling that not many of you actually are right-wing Republicans? I can't think what gives me that impression, but it's probably the case, right? But wherever you are, even if you are a right-wing Republican, we're all suffering from this hideous sense of disillusionment about what politics is like. So isn't it nice to go to one point in American history, namely 1776, where all our leaders seem to be wise, virtuous, strong, reasonable, and victorious? Except, of course, it ain't entirely so. It's the mark of really grown-up history. Where does history begin? You tell me. It's an exam. Thucydides.
Really?
Yeah. History of the Peloponnesian Wars. That's where Western history. It's the first great Western history book.
Well, that's the first written history, but there's oral history.
I meant, absolutely. I meant the first written history. You caught me out. That's very good. But the first written history, I mean, we're going to get calls saying Herodotus, which is quite right. But Thucydides, what's moving about the history of the Peloponnesian War? It's a history of a disaster. It's written by an angry retired general, does this sound familiar, accusing his own country, Athens, of imperial overreach. And that's why the book is so powerful, because history is a mirror of self-criticism. That's what makes history for a true democracy strong enough to say, have mea culpa moments, saying, you know, we were born in sin, guilt, stupidity, and incompetence. Yet we can actually be more free and more strong by actually understanding that honestly.
Yeah, but understanding that honestly is really complicated, and that's not
why
how history is usually presented.
Well, you know, the Germans after the war, what everyone thinks about that experience after the war, unlike the Japanese, the first thing they did was make sure their kids understood exactly what had happened under the Third Reich, they could move on from there.
I think this would be a very different political climate if the United States had done the same thing after the Vietnam War in a very honest way.
Right. Instead of just having collective amnesia.
Right,
exactly.
I think
exactly.
That's right. But when we go back to Revolutionary War, one of the things that really struck me, in 1775, when the British realized that they might lose their American colonies, Lord North offers a compromise to the Patriots. He won't tax them if they'll promise to add to the costs of common defense, but he refuses to let them trade outside the empire, and that seems to be the sticking point. So do you think that despite all the rhetoric about liberty, that at its core, the American Revolution was really about free trade?
Wow, it's a tough and very good question. You know what I think it's about? I mean, I think those are important things, but no, I don't fundamentally. You know what I think the most important word in the Declaration of Independence is? The first one. Do you remember what that is?
When.
Exactly. There is a sense in America, whatever the actual proximate arguments are, is this, in some curious normative way, humiliating, actually, not to be sovereign of your own affairs. And if it hadn't been in 75 and it hadn't been about free trade, it would have been about something else. It would have been about the British government's compromise, as it was seen with the Roman Catholics, which caused a huge amount of kind of hysteria in the Protestant world of New England. Something else would have come along because it was a kind of when moment.
Just because of the time.
Yeah, because this is a grown-up, independent, feisty, politically articulate, rich society, really. So there's always going to become some sort of marginal cause. I mean, the tea thing is sort of ludicrous, you know. I mean, it's sort of idiotic in Boston, really. It could easily, you know, if that was really the problem, then the whole problem of American sovereignty would have gone away. The Friends of America in the Houses of Parliament in Britain, like Lord Chatham, like Granville Sharp in my book, are horrified by the British policy of military enforcement. So they want the war to go away. They hate the government policy. They vote against it over and over again. But they ultimately think, in Britain, that sovereignty belongs to Parliament. not to the House of Burgesses, not to, you know, when in matters of peace and war, all the things that fundamentally mattered. And you can devolve some of that sovereignty in tax policy, sure. But say, you know, who chooses the next war for which Americans would have to pay? On Sir Westminster chooses it from their point of view. Now, that was a problem that's not ever going to be bridged by negotiations about free trade.
Right. So that whole free trade thing kind of was a facade for a lot of problems that were hiding
behind it. It's a symptom, I think, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Now, one of the source documents in your book was the Book of Negroes.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about that book?
Sure. We're in New York at the end of the war in 1783. There are 3,000 freed slaves who've been living in some economic distress, mostly in an awful area called Negro Town, but they've been legally married. The children had little documents which said born free behind British lines. Incredibly moving moment. And at that moment, Washington comes along and says, we'll have our Negroes back, thank you very much. There was a clause added at the last minute to the Provisional Peace Treaty, which said there should be no carrying off by the British forces of property and Negroes.
That was one thing that
shocking,
really
yeah.
struck me about yeah. the whole experience of the African Americans there, was it's all so precarious.
Very.
They have their little piece of paper,
Very.
But that doesn't mean anything
no,
if somebody
right.
can just no, haul
right.
them off in the middle of the
that's
night.
That's right. There's a very moving little document by the Methodist preacher, Boston King, who later becomes a preacher, which begins saying, when peace was declared between Britain and America, there was universal enthusiasm except for us, and describes very movingly slave catchers prowling the streets of New York. But the British commander-in-chief steps up to that moment, and there's a summit conference with Washington, and Washington says, we want our Negroes back, and he says, you can't, they're free, they're coming with us, in effect. And so what then happens, in fact, what's already happened before the summit conference, is a joint commission is set up in the docks, sometimes at Francis Tavern, famously, and sometimes on the docks, and sometimes on the ships. And what that commission does is, there's a long line of black faces, and they all come to the desk, and they tell the commissioners when they left the plantations, and they go right from 1775 almost to the very end of the war, who they left, how old they were, what they did if they weren't a field hand, with whom they went. The commissioners note their physical condition. Stout Negroes, so-called, were healthy ones. Worn out were those who were not healthy. And this is done in 3,000 cases. This was to make sure that they'd come to the British before the peace treaty. Only if you kind of snuck under the lines before peace broke out did you qualify to go free with the British forces. So what we have in the so-called Book of Negroes is 3,000 potted biographies, just a couple of sentences long. But for once, these African Americans aren't just generic. They have names and faces. And it's just, can't tell you how moving it is. It's actually been published by, in a fine edition by the historian Graham Russell Hodges. And so you learn, for example, of these grannies, you know, carrying four-year-olds with them because the mother and father had disappeared or died of smallpox. Lots of women travel together. That was very unusual. 80% of all runaways before the war were, as you'd expect, strong adult males. It's almost 50-50, actually, women and men. Women travel in family groups to an extraordinary degree when they're making their exodus down the rivers and creeks of the Chesapeake Valley. So you can see in names and faces and ages an entire world, actually, of that amazing runaway moment.
Yeah, that just struck me as an incredible document. It sounds like it's worth reading just all
it
in
is
itself.
Actually. It is, actually, yeah.
Now, this is kind of a complete change of subject, but...
You want to talk about baseball?
Right, no.
That's too bad. Punk rock.
I came across an article that you wrote for The Guardian on the first anniversary of 9/11. And it was really intriguing. You had one of the sentences that caught my eye was you said, in the unedifying spectacle of the sucker economy, there is, as the midterm elections draws close, fuel for serious public contention, an argument in fact.
It couldn't have been the midterm elections, right? It was the presidential election in 2004.
No, this was a year after
9/11. Oh, okay.
So this was 2002.
Okay, all right.
Right.
Yeah.
an argument, in fact, over the relative claims of community or corporation in post 9/11 America.
Jeez, did I write that?
What did you mean by the sucker economy?
Enron. That's exactly what I meant.
You mean?
I meant Enron, you know, which is still with us, isn't it, Mrs. Skilling? And what I meant was, actually, it seems there are many things, and I'm speaking as someone who's lived half my life in Britain, half my life in America, is passionately loyal to both countries. I defend America constantly, which sounds like special plea, but it's just the case because a lot of Brits have a grotesquely stereotyped view about, you know, what we all think about politics and how we behave, and there is a slightly mistaken view sometimes about Britain, overly sympathetic sometimes in this country. So anyway, after that little bit of special pleading and sort of Surgeon General's warning, what I mean is I think there are lots of things wrong with politics at the moment in the United States and the economy, and they're connected. We have become an oligarchy. We've woken up in the 21st century to find we're actually in the Hanoverian England, out of which America fled. By which I mean, guess what? Do you know much about Hanoverian England?
No.
It was full of money. You didn't actually get power unless you paid people off. There were dynasties of families, like, you know, the 94th Bush, running politics. There were lobbyists running amok in Westminster. Gee, we seem to have not gone that far away from 18th century Britain after all. We've become an oligarchy again in America, and one of the most upsetting things to me about it is this extraordinary revolving door, really, between corruptly gained political office, which turns into, you know, yesterday's corruptly gained political administrator turns into tomorrow's lobbyist, who then, you know, phones up his friends and takes them round for a round of golf, and the whole system rolls on and on and on. This sort of horrible black comedy with what was his name in it, Mr. Foggo, is just, again, classically an example of the sucker economy. You might say it's the sucker economy shakes hands with the sucker polity.
Because people are not paying attention to what's going
and
on.
And how people are not paying attention. If people are paying attention, they would really not have bought the view that by attacking Iraq, we were doing something like 9/11. I mean, John Kerry, not my favorite political campaign in the history of the United States, but he did at one point in one of the debates said, well, you know, why don't we attack Belgium if it's sort of completely arbitrary country? It wasn't Mexico. Mexico. If it's just a country, you know, that we're choosing to attack in order to show we're doing something, why
we
not?
We need somebody to beat up on.
Yeah, we need, well, you know, the view in the right was any towel head will do, right? Any Arab will do, because they're all the same. Well, guess what? They're not all the same.
Well, I think that was a lot of the followers, but I think the neocons and, you know, the Project for New American Century had a very specific
agenda.
They
did, but that's not that. But they didn't talk about the agenda because they would have lost votes in the presidential election.
Right.
The presidential election was entirely about... aren't you glad George Bush is president? Because he did something about 9/11. But what he did, of course, was something which actually made it harder, not easier, to deal with Al-Qaeda. He did something which created terrorism, not actually contained it. But it's all too difficult, because guess what? American schools aren't great at geography.
No. I remember seeing this Australian TV program where they had put Iraq in Australia on a map, and they're saying, well, no, it was Iran. They labeled Australia Iran, and they asked Americans, well, what country should we invade next?
and they're
pointing to Australia and going, Iran.
Right. No, I think the more serious point is actually that it didn't, you know, that the so much was riding on actually people understanding the difference between the Afghanistan war, which was entirely, in my view, you know, legitimate, what everyone thinks of it, at least there was a point in going after the Taliban, and the Iraq war, which was kind of completely the wrong war to fight, if you're actually very upset about what happened in 9/11. And those who actually believe that you can sell a bill of goods in which you essentially deceive the soporific American political public into equating Iraq with the solution to 9/11 worked brilliantly. So it's kind of all of our fault, really, those of us who are upset by that, in not doing a good enough education campaign to say how wrong is this.
Well, you know, I think a lot of The way that history is taught, too, is a problem for that, because if you look at the past in these simple black and white terms, then it's easier to try to look at the present in those same kind of black and white cartoon terms.
Easy victors and villains.
Exactly.
I agree with you. I think there are moments in history where you simply can't do it. Or maybe you can. I was going to say the Civil War was a problem, but of course, actually, there... You know, anybody from the right can sort of sanctify Lincoln enough, really, unless you're, you know.
Yeah.
But you're right. Basically, I believe you're right. History is not, history, you know, one of the glories of history is its complexity, I think, actually. But, you know, complexity makes people rush out and buy a copy of People magazine.
Right. I've thought often that history shouldn't be taught to children, that it should be taught to adults, because you have to come to a sort of adult understanding to really be able to comprehend it, as opposed to thinking that you have an understanding when you've got this totally simplistic outlook.
I think that's a sort of pessimistic view of what kids are up for. I think we are so wired for wanting to know about our ancestry. I go around to schools, and the nearest thing I did to, you know, as it were, bringing history to children was, of course, to do a 15-part television series. But there I did what I call debate by stealth. The first thing you have to do in television history is tell an incredibly gripping story, what we call bums in seats in the BBC. You have to really rivet people to make sure they don't switch over to football. Once you've done that, you can then raise all kinds of painful and difficult questions, actually, and people won't treat it like homework, actually. And I think you actually, I know you can do it with children, because actually go around to elementary schools sometimes talking about history, and they love it, actually.
Well, that's history taught then, I suppose, the way it should be taught.
It needs exuberance and enthusiasm. It needs natural storytelling. What it doesn't need are gigantic social studies textbooks produced by McGraw-Hill, the size of your average Velociraptor or bigger, which are designed to actually leech all the fascination out of history.
Right, reduce it to a set of dates and all the humanities.
Or
gone.
Kind of, you know, like a commentary on... the problem of the week on the op-ed pages, really. History isn't simply the footnotes of the past for current events. It's entirely wrong to rob history of its romance, with a very, very small r, of its sense that a wonderful phrase that W.H. Auden talked about history is breaking bread with the dead. And it's just like thinking about Granny or going through her suitcase in the loft or something like that. There is this kind of wonderful kind of psychic connection that we need to make, actually, with our ancestry, but at the same time not to do it in a spirit of... you know, sentimental reverence.
Right. Ask the hard questions.
Yes, absolutely.
And look at it honestly.
Yeah.
I've been talking to Simon Sharma. He's a professor of history and art history at Columbia University, and we've been talking about his latest book, Rough Crossings. It's been fascinating. Thank you so much
Thank
for
you.
Coming
Lovely
by.
Lovely conversation. Thank you for having
Thank
me.
Thank you.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.